from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we visit a quake-ravaged region outside Nepal's capital. A call for greater understanding of the players in Syria. Resuming the task of reaching a final Iran nuclear deal. And is cyber war inevitable?
Some analysts I speak with say it's not a matter of if or when, but now that we're already at cyber war. Several told me that flat out.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The death toll from Saturday's devastating earthquake in Nepal has risen to nearly 5,500 people. The UN is making an urgent appeal for $415 million to provide shelter for 500,000 people who are sleeping out in the open, as well as medicine, water, and food for millions affected by the quake. It said the disaster destroyed 70,000 houses and damaged more than 500,000 others. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is traveling outside the capital city, Kathmandu.
We've traveled over a road which has just been cleared of landslides in a four-wheel drive vehicle. And then from a smaller earthquake damaged road, we've hiked down a trail on a steep terrace paddy field to the banks of the Indravati River. And we are now in a village called Majigal, where every single structure has been reduced to a pile of rubble. We're talking about 50 homes in all. The human toll is remarkably low, considering the utter devastation. Five people dead, one teenage boy is missing. About 20 injured have been taken away, and there are still a few of the seriously injured who cannot move are still in the village. Besides the total loss of their houses and concern about how they're going to rebuild, and even if they should rebuild these similar type of structures, fearing another earthquake in the future, the big tragic loss for the people here in Majigal, which has primarily been a fishing community, and we've heard this from all the villages we've stopped in, is the loss of their livestock. What happened here, when the earthquake struck, it was in the hot part of the day. People were taking their meal break, and they had tied up all their livestock in the shed. So when the earthquake hit, the animals could not flee. And so each family had five or six animals, whether they were goats, chickens, cows, whatever. They've lost them all. And this is just a tremendous financial loss for all these people.
Where are you traveling to?
We have gone to the northeast of Kathmandu, best as I can tell. Let me put it this way. Probably this village, Majigal, spelled, by the way, M-A-J-I-G-A-O-N. Majigal was probably not on very many maps before the earthquake, and now it's literally been wiped off the map. And what we're finding is it's not necessarily just proximity to the epicenter where we have seen the most destruction. It seems to have depended on the way that the waves have traveled through the hills and valleys and sort of what type of structures were built.
Do you get the sense the people you see need all kinds of help, food, water, shelter, medical supplies?
In many places, absolutely yes. In this particular village, they are relatively fortunate because they're on the banks of a river, so they have access to running water. And what they have done, they have gone in to the nearest town of any size called Malamchi, which we passed through, and they have made an arrangement with shopkeepers there to get on credit 30 sacks of rice. And each sack is about 30 kilograms, and that's what they're surviving on for now. But they're, very uncertain what is going to be the future for them as far as meals after those sacks of rice are all empty.
And what about aftershocks?
We've been fortunate here this afternoon when we've been frankly, in very precarious places where if a big aftershock came, we could expect a lot of debris to fall on us. We felt one aftershock last evening in Kathmandu, and there was another this morning. And one hamlet that we stopped in on the way here, they told us that the aftershock last night had further brought down a damaged home and killed one man who was had gone back to his house to try to retrieve some belongings.
Thanks, Steve. VOA correspondent Steve Herman traveling outside quake-ravaged Kathmandu, Nepal. U.S. President Barack Obama discussed aid efforts in a telephone call with Nepal's prime minister. The U.S. is providing more than $10 million for both immediate efforts, such as clean water and search and rescue operations, and for long-term recovery efforts. A new study by noted Middle East expert Faisal Attani concludes that the United States could greatly improve the chances of success of a serious policy by gaining a better understanding of local players and power dynamics. Attani is a resident scholar at the Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council in Washington. In a new book titled Defeating the Jihadists in Syria, Competition Before Confrontation, he argues that the current U.S.-led campaign will not be able to destroy the militant group known as the Islamic State without effective, legitimate Syrian ground forces. He says the U.S. train and equip strategy, which involves recruiting Syrians to fight ISIS but not the Assad government, will backfire, discrediting the fighters and boosting support for the extremists. Attani explained his prescription for improving Washington's Syria strategy in an interview with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
In general, I think the United States has demonstrated it hasn't really grasped the priorities of the Syrian civilian population and the priorities of the various fighting groups on the ground. I believe that as a result, its actions have undermined the moderate or nationalist opposition on the ground, empowered Jabhat al-Nusra, and done not much at all to weaken ISIS. I believe that the nature of its air campaign, as well as the intentions behind its train and equip program, reflect this. The Syrian priorities I'm talking about are, firstly, within the ranks of the insurgency, they are much more preoccupied with capability against the regime, whether that's monetary capability or other forms of military capability, rather than this or that particular ideology of whatever group the U.S. doesn't like. And at the civilian level, it also is not very an ideological, it's not an ideological issue, and that's why people are learning to tolerate the radical Islamist groups. People in Syria want security, and they want governance, they want protection from regime violence.
You also noted that the current U.S.-led campaign cannot destroy ISIS without effective, legitimate Syrian ground forces. Would the train and equip program for several thousand Syrian fighters fill that gap?
I don't believe so. Not necessarily because it's too small, although that may be the case. I believe if train and equip leads to, for example, a force of 15,000 very well-armed, very well-trained, well-motivated fighters with coherent leadership, they could make quite an impact in Syria. I mean, Hezbollah has done so with many less fighters than that. However, I'm concerned about a couple of things. Firstly, the speed of the program and the rate at which it plans to graduate recruits, if you will. And second of all, even more problematic, is the mission. It appears that the mission of these train and equip fighters, as the United States has defined it, is to fight the jihadi groups in Syria, not to fight the regime. I think any group that's tasked solely with fighting jihadi groups without fighting the regime as well is going to fail, both militarily and because it's going to be seen as illegitimate or a sort of U.S. mercenary force by Syrian population.
But how could empowering Syrian rebels achieve three goals: weakening the Assad regime, counter al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front, and confront the threat of ISIS?
I don't believe the immediate issue is throwing a moderate or nationalist opposition into Syria and asking to destroy everybody at the same time. Really, the key point is, are they able to take territory, control resources, provide governance? Those successes can then be built on. The idea is not that we ought to push for a direct confrontation between them and all these other actors. In fact, that's quite the opposite of the idea. The idea is to enable them to become competitive actors within the context of the Syrian civil war for leadership of the insurgency. I believe personally that because the insurgency social base is Sunni Arab, and because the jihadi problem is a Sunni problem at the end of the day, that these are the only forces who are going to be capable of providing basically a lasting solution to the jihadi problem. Every time we throw something else at it, like Shia militias or Alawi regime or etc., we just feed this narrative of the oppression of Sunnis at the hands of minorities. And this narrative really is Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS's primary recruitment tool. I can't overemphasize that.
Final question, Faisal. What are the major recommendations you offered in your study to revise the United States strategy in Syria?
Well, there are plenty of sort of detailed recommendations at the tactical level, but I think to summarize, I think we need to fundamentally reimagine what mission we have in mind for our allies on the ground in Syria, to broaden that mission so that it reflects more closely their own priorities of fighting the regime, to allow them to compete before confronting Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. They need to be able to do that, otherwise the confrontation is going to be futile. The specifics of this entail, A, in addition to obviously redefining the mission, our mission, it is uniting and making coherent funding streams and weapon streams, shifting our airstrikes in the north to target areas that are front lines between ISIS and the nationalist opposition, and ceasing to make public statements that are undermining the nationalist opposition. Territorially, I see the southern front and the southern battle space in Syria as the ideal territory to build on some pretty decent gains we've made as a result of a covert collaboration and train and equip program between our personnel and rebel forces in the south.
Middle East expert Faisal Itani, resident scholar at the Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says negotiators from his government and six world powers are beginning the task of drafting a final nuclear agreement today in New York. In remarks to an audience at New York University Wednesday, Zarif said Tehran wants to reach a deal with the so-called P5 plus one before the June 30th deadline. He called the emerging nuclear agreement an opportunity that should not be missed.
I think we have general agreement on the concept, which we call parameters of an agreement. Now, how we transform that agreement into a written, in our view, legally binding document, which will be endorsed by a mandatory resolution of the Security Council, that is the area where we need to do a lot of work, because usually in these negotiations, the devil is in the detail. And we have done some detail during our discussion in Lausanne, but there is some left, and it includes all areas. It's not one specific area of difficulty. We need to put down on several pieces of paper, not on one piece of paper, all the details of an agreement. I believe it can be done. I believe it should be done. I believe it's an opportunity for all of us which should not be missed. I expect people to start working in good faith and move forward. It's a good agreement. It's an agreement that does not reflect all the needs of everybody. Obviously, if you wanted an agreement that reflected every need of every player in the room, you'll never have an agreement. So everybody has to be flexible, everybody has to compromise, and I think people recognize the significance of this opportunity to reach an agreement. It's not a perfect agreement. It's not perfect for us, it's not perfect for the United States, it's not perfect for our European Union partners, but it's the best we can get. It's the best anybody can get.
The Iranian diplomat also said Tehran is prepared to accept an additional protocol of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to provide what he calls the highest level of international transparency on its nuclear activities. He also said his government expects international sanctions will be lifted within days of a final deal. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told a U.N. conference on nuclear non-proliferation Monday in New York that a deal with Tehran would make the world safer. Also, under U.S. Secretary of State Wendy Sherman told a Jewish audience in Washington the pact would give new protection to Israel by increasing the length of time it would take for Tehran to develop any nuclear weaponry.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
President Barack Obama pledged to put cyber issues at the core of his legislative agenda. He sought to change how the public and private sector share information about online threats and bolster some privacy protections for citizens while maintaining a robust national security agency. Now the administration is turning its attention to Washington's two central pillars of national security, the military and espionage services. VOA's Doug Bernard covers cyber issues for us, and he joins me now in the studio. Hey, Doug, thanks for coming.
Great to be here, as always.
Thank you. Hey, Doug, what's the administration up to?
So just in the past month, earlier in April, CIA Director William Brennan released a blueprint for the future in which he vowed to put the digital domain, in his words, at the very center of all CIA operations. And then just last week, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter, in a speech out at Stanford, vowed he warned potential adversaries that the U.S. will respond to cyber attacks. He said using digital weapons of, quote, blunt force trauma, as well as potentially conventional weapons as well. So these are two very robust, you could even say muscular statements from the Pentagon and the CIA laying out their vision and their embrace of the cybersphere.
Well, it sounds like the U.S. is preparing for a full-out cyber war, is it?
Well, I think to some degree every nation, every technically sophisticated nation is preparing in some ways for, let's just say, cyber battle. But part of the problem here, your question strikes at, is what is cyber war? And everybody seems to have a different answer, including various military strategists, analysts, security professionals. This is a very important question to answer. Think about conventional warfare. Over centuries, nations around the world have put together a fairly codified law. It's called jus in bello, or the law of war. And it really sets out parameters of what's acceptable, what's not, how wars are declared, how they're ended, how people are treated. Nothing like that exists in the cybersphere. And that, I think, is causing a great deal of worry, because that really means that, quote, cyber war is as not only undefined, but it is also very unpredictable. And that's making a lot of people very nervous.
So with these new policies, is the Obama administration now trying to write its own rules of war?
No, probably not, because any nation setting out its own rules of war really doesn't have any meaning. It has to be something that nations collectively do together. I think what a lot of analysts we've been speaking with, what might be happening here is that the administration is, as they say, signaling other people. Think about the nuclear era and the Cold War. The United States, the Soviet Union, and their allies and adversaries would signal each other through statements, through press releases, through speeches, that kind of thing, about their willingness and intent to use nuclear weapons if necessary, but to, you know, try not to use them, etc. And so what happened is you established this kind of detente, not through direct negotiations, but just this sort of signaling. So what actually may be happening here is that William Brennan and Secretary Carter and the Obama administration is starting to signal its friends, its allies, and even, you know, some potential adversaries about what it will do, or what it actually, more accurately, what it may do if there is serious cyber attack launched against the United States.
Do the analysts you've been speaking with think that cyber war is inevitable?
Everyone has a different answer. Some analysts I speak with say it's not a matter of if or when, but now, that we're already at cyber war. Several told me that flat out. Others disagree. They shy away from that word because war has really some, I think, definite meanings. War involves, you know, the intentional hurting or killing of populations, destroying infrastructure, that kind of thing. So when people say, for example, the Sony hack was an act of war, cyber war, well, no one was really hurt there. Nothing was really destroyed. The company was embarrassed. A bad movie got delayed from release for a little while. But, you know, is that really an act of war? So what it seems like is happening is that nations are trying to establish some sense as to what war constitutes. And the analysts, again, that we've been speaking with, those that do not believe that we are at war, one said, in fact, that they believe the consequences of a, quote, cyber war could be so destructive, not just nation to nation, but globally, that that pressure alone may be enough to actually really prevent any kind of future skirmish.
I heard something interesting the other day. If you're having a cyber war, you need cyber soldiers.
Yes.
And these high school students are being hired by these big companies because they're so tech savvy. They're coming up with brand new programs
yes.
to prevent the latest cyber attacks. And they say that they're so good at this and they're in such demand, they're making really good money.
Yes, they are.
That they employers forget that these are high school students and they have to go to class. And they call them right in the middle of a gym class or yeah. math or something. It's
right.
really
biology.
What do you know about these kids that are getting so rich so young in high school?
Well, this is fascinating because when you think again of traditional, you know, weapons and warfare, there's always been a race to have the best weapon, the newest weapon, or the newest deterrence. Things are just moving so much faster in the cybersphere now that young people who have grown up in this matrix of cyber from the time they were born, to them it just comes very often so much more naturally. And particularly, it's not that they're math geniuses in all cases or, you know, computer whizzes, but they've just grown up and they're seeing solutions or possible advancements that we just can't see because, again, we didn't grow up in that matrix of cyber.
Different world.
It is a different world.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by. I always enjoy chatting with you.
As do I.
Okay. That's VOA's cyber guy, Doug Bernard. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Oh, but before you leave, let me ask you, you got a story about this on the web.
We do have a story about this on the web, and it's really the beginning of a series. There's so much to dig in here that we're titling the series The Weaponization of the Web. We have our first story out. It's online, and I expect more to be coming in the future.
So that's www.voanews.com.
That's exactly right.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us today for International Edition. And I'll remind you that you can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day, as well as Doug's article on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains deeply concerned about the fate of Ukrainian hostages that Russia continues to hold on Russian territory in defiance of the Minsk ceasefire agreement. Among these is Nadia Savchenko, a member of the Verkhovna Rada and of Ukraine's delegation to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. She was captured by Russia-backed separatists last year and transferred to Russian custody. Ms. Savchenko was charged in connection with a June 2014 mortar attack that killed two Russian journalists covering the conflict between government forces and Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. She has held a lengthy hunger strike protesting her arrest and insisting the charges against her are fabricated. The United States is deeply concerned about the state of Ms. Savchenko's health and urges that she be examined by a doctor appointed by the Ukrainian embassy. Another hostage is Oleg Sentsov. He has been held in pretrial detention for nearly a year since his arrest in Crimea on May 11, 2014. He was arrested on trumped-up terrorism charges. It was announced on April 8 that Sentsov's pretrial detention would once again be extended until at least May 11th. Speaking at the hearing on April 8th in Moscow's Lefortovo District Court, Mr. Sentsov reportedly said that he could not agree with the decision to extend his custody since there hadn't been any evidence presented of his alleged participation in or organization of terrorist activities in Crimea last year. The fact that Ukrainian consular officials have not been able to visit Mr. Sentsov at all since his arrest compounds the illegality of Russia's actions in Crimea, said U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Daniel Baer. The United States again calls on Russia and the separatists it backs to follow through on their Minsk commitments and release immediately Ms. Savchenko, Mr. Sentsov, and all of the other Ukrainians unlawfully detained in Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email,
visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.